Okay, this is Homefront South Dakota, and I'm in Vermilion with Norm Heron. You were in the service in World War II. What branch of service were you in?
Navy.
And what was your rank?
The final rank was Lieutenant JG.
What were you at when you went in?
Well, I went to Notre Dame for my Navy training. The first month was apprentice seaman at $21 a month. I only received 15 of it. Then I was promoted to midshipman at $65 a month for the next 3 months. And then I received my commission in January. I'm not sure exactly what the pay was, but I was getting married right then. And so I had taken out an allotment of $175 a month to be sent to her, and also a $25 war bond. I had 3 weeks leave. After 3 weeks, I had to report to New Orleans Naval Base down there, and my ship wasn't in. And since they didn't have quarters for me, I received $7 a day per diem. And also, since I was assigned to a ship, I got sea pay. So, and since I was married, it was something over $300 a month then because of that. And so the each day I had to go report to the naval base. Is LST 528 here? No, it isn't. So all I had to do was initial the muster book, NGH, repeat it 24 hours later, and did that for, it was 19 days before the ship came. And I went aboard that ship, LST 528, at 10:55 a.m. as it was being commissioned on the 29th day of February. And the first order that I received, the captain told me to start a ship store. He didn't tell me how. I went to the yeoman's office thinking that it'd be information there, but since it was a new ship, it'd just been built, and nothing. So what do? I decided I had to probably, where the compartment would be for different items, it would be down by crew's quarters. So I went down and I found a compartment that had a door that could be locked. Also, it had a pass-through window, and loaded with shells. Okay, now, how did I buy the provisions? So I went up and asked the captain, is it okay if I would ask the crew for some money? And he said, oh, yes, and he handed me a $20 bill. And the other officers kicked in 10. And since the crew had, a lot of the crew had been on leave in Louisville, Kentucky, waiting for the ship to be built at Jeffersonville, Indiana, across the river, not a great number of them had money, but I did get $7.50 for a number of them. And while I was interviewing, I asked if any of them had had any experience working in a store, clerking in a store. And one guy by the name of Kilgallen, he was a second-class pharmacist, he said he had, and he was getting approaching 30 years of age at that time. And so I told him I'd give him $25 a month if he would have the store open 1 hour before chow time in the evening and 1 hour after chow time. So then I took a couple of the crew over to the PX at the naval base and bought Lucky Strikes and Camels and candy and razor blades and razors, different things that the crew might want. Had that in the store, so that was just part of my duty. They were five of us officers that was qualified to be on watch while the ship was underway. So we had 4 hour watches in it. It was.
So describe what being on watch meant and what was that like? Well,
you were up on the bridge. You were in charge of the ship. The ship was yours. And then when I became a communications officer a few months, the ship was also mine when general quarters were sounded, battle station. The ship was mine until the captain came and relieved me. But I still stayed on there, and he'd give me an order, and I would give the order down the voice tube to the wheelhouse, whether what speed, you know, was going, so on and so forth. And the different speeds we had on the enunciators was 1/3, 2/3, standard, full, and flight were the speeds. But usually, when we were traveling, it was usually a standard speed, which was about from 7 to 8 miles per hour.
Where did you go on this ship?
Well, from after being in New Orleans for a week, we went to Panama City, Florida for 2 weeks for a shakedown cruise. That was a training cruise.
Okay.
And we were there for 2 weeks. We went back to New Orleans, and we loaded with all the fuel oil and so on and so forth and all supplies that we could. We went around to New York, and we were there a couple of days, and then we went to Leonardo Beach, New Jersey. And we were a guinea pig. They were going to load us completely, our tank deck completely up, with different types of ammunition. They sent an ordnance officer from Washington, D.C. to supervise the loading. And also, they sent him across with us, too. We left the States on the 18th of April of 1944, and it took about 3 days to get the whole convoy together of 127 ships. And since we were loaded with that ammunition, we were in the last ship in our column. And we had a few baby flat tops that was flying around in the air of the day to watch for subs. And we had to make one turn south because of the iceberg. But it took us 19 days to get across. They took us to Falmouth, but they took us 5-6 miles up River Fall, and we were there about a week. Nobody wanted us. And so what we did, we managed to play a little softball out in the pastures. You know what we use for bases.
Of course.
And then finally we got orders, and there was a couple destroyers came and got us. We took us on the way to Plymouth. But on the way, our executive officer, he saw a sub surfacing. So he rang General Quarters and the sub. Well, we knew that just one bullet to our side would destroy all of us. Mm-hmm. But it turned, as soon as I got topside, it was an English submarine there. And so we went to Plymouth, and but they wouldn't let us stay at night in the harbor. We had to stay out at sea because they felt if we were in the harbor and Germans came over and bombed us, we would destroy the whole harbor. So every morning, the pilot would take us up to a stream to where the longshoremen unloaded us. We took about a week to unload that. We also had an LCT aboard. Then we went to Southampton, and we tilted the ship and let the LCT slide off. I've got even a picture of the ship with an LCT on it. Also, On May the 31st, which was a Wednesday, we got orders what we were supposed to do on the next 5 days. Thursday, we didn't have to do anything. On Friday, we had to go up to Tilbury, up to the Thames River. See, we were at South End on the Sea at that particular time. There were okay. About 30 or more of LSTs were at South End on the Sea. Went up to Tilbury, which was just about 20 miles south of London. And on Saturday, we loaded our tanks and trucks and jeeps and so on and so forth, and we went back down to South End on Sea. And of course, we were supposed to take off the evening of the 4th, but we got orders. It was delayed for a day. So it was 24 hours before we took off. We went through the Straits of Dover. And in censoring the crew's mail, they all wrote about seeing the white cliffs of Dover, but they didn't see any bluebirds. And that was one of their favorite songs that was played over and over all the time. And we arrived off the Normandy beach before daylight on D-Day. And we had a few ducks, 8, 9 or 10 of them, which was tanks that could go in water. And we let those off. They went in at just daylight. And at 9 o'clock, we had 6 LCVPs aboard, which had a crew of 4. Those were was to haul troops from troop ships in to shore. And so we let those off. They were 6 of them with 4 men, and then 2 officers went with them. So we got rid of 26 men at that particular time. But we were set up for third wave. We weren't too happy. We preferred the first wave. But it was third wave, and we went out on Juno Beach, which was a Canadian beach, and we had the Canadians and the tanks and everything, and they were men. They had already been down in Africa and stuff. We had a lot of respect for those guys, and there were no kids among them.
So were your guys quite a bit less experienced?
I didn't think so. I thought we had we were as good as anybody. But the training, the 2 weeks training that we had at Panama City, Florida, mm-hmm. we were just but. Of course, I think those others were over there longer than we were. But the beach, you know, got so jammed up. And it was the next afternoon on the 5th before the second wave went in. And then it was 2 o'clock in the morning on the 8th, on Thursday morning. I was on watch from midnight to 4 o'clock. And about 2 o'clock, and the seas was very rough. And we were slipping. See, the anchor doesn't hold the ship. It's the weight of the chain that holds the ship. Mm-hmm. And so we were taught at Notre Dame, if it starts happening, you let out more chain. But the problem was we were slipping and we were getting close to another ship. and I was about to go wake the captain up to move our ship when an officer from the shore came aboard and told us, go in. But we couldn't go straight in because of all the mines that was there, so we had to go at an angle. And two of our officers was up on the bow of the ship watching for those mines, and so they guided us into the shore. So we hit the shore, and when the tide went out, there we sat high and dry. We let our tanks off. Then we went and picked up wounded there, and we had three Canadian doctors and 12 corpsmen, and we took, I don't know, a number of the wounded. See, on D-Day, there was almost 10,000 killed, but there were 41,500 and some that was wounded. So they were all picked up by different ships on that day and taken, come back to England. But it was very pitiful, I'm telling you.
So what was it like for you to see kind of the aftermath of D-Day and see those
terrible,
how many wounded? And
it was, and some of them, you didn't see what their wound was, but they their bugged eyes out, just no motion at all. No motion at all. It was something that was terrible. And therefore, I didn't watch Saving Private Ryan. I didn't watch that movie because
just because you feel that yeah, you might not be able to.
And there were other things that happened too that bothered me. One morning, a few days later, while we were in a storm about approximately the 19th of June, and we were headed back to England, and we were just two ships, the flotilla commander's in his ship in front of us. And when I went on to watch it, and the wind was only 110 miles an hour. When I went on to watch at midnight, the officer of the deck that was there ahead of me, I always went up 15 minutes before time at dark because I wanted to get my eyes accustomed. He was having hard left rudder and hard right rudder and so on and so forth. And, of course, it was lightning, so the sky was lit up completely all the time. And when I took over, I gave the order to left center rudder, which was 20 degrees left, and hold it because it would go, but it'd take it over, but it'd come back. And then that old steel deck with the wells, you could see that is lit up. So I had a radio message sent to the flotilla commander in the ship in front of us, request permission to reduce speed. He came back with speed reduction request denied. I said, go jump in the lake. But and anyway, I called the engine room. I'd figured out how many RPMs that could be taken off that they could do. I wanted to cut the speed 1/3. And so I told him what to take it off. I said, do it slowly. I don't want it to just... If we did it all at once, the captain might hear it. But they called me back and told me when they had it, and it made a world of difference. So it's just one of the things that happened, you know. And there was a number of things, too, different times. And I wasn't afraid to take action. The reason I did that was because there's over 100 crewmen down there, and I was responsible for that. I felt it was my responsibility to see that they arrived safe. So I took that chance and did it. And when we got to port, I looked for that ship that the flotilla commander was on, but I couldn't find it. Now, one of two things happened. It broke in two that night, because some ships did. Or he got orders to go to a different port. That I didn't know. It was a problem, but I never hesitated to do it, even on Christmas Eve of 44, which I wrote a story on that too, that I did think. I felt that I came out of this service a better person than I was when I went in.
Well, think about you're such a young guy, and you have so much responsibility on your shoulders.
We were all interviewed in November of 43 at Notre Dame. See, there was a little over 1,000 of us there. There was about 1,500 reported, but they told us the first day, look at the guy on your left, look at the guy on your right. One of you three is going to be gone within 4 weeks. And it was true. There were seven of us from Southern Illinois University at Carpentale, and three was gone within, four of us made it all the way. I was raised on a farm, way down the southern tip of Illinois. And at age 10, I was on a hay baling crew. It took a man's place there. Mm-hmm. And why they asked me to do it, I don't know, but I did it. We worked 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, 60 hours, and on Saturday night, I got $4 and a half. I got 7.5 cents an hour. I think that helped. And then growing up in the summer of, at the end of my junior high school year, starting the senior year, Dad told me, he said, I don't need you on the farm if you can find a job. Well, I went to this large farm that I worked on and started the next day. They had six or seven teams. They had about at least 10 guys working all the time. And they had five, six or so go to their teams, took them to plow corn. And after they left, the foreman told me, he says, take that black mule and the red mule and go. I was expecting, because they had tried for a couple of years to work that black mule and they hadn't done it. So when I roped him and was putting the bridle in, also a tube of sugar went in his mouth at the same time, because I had used, it was the horse that I rode to high school, I had her doing tricks and I'd give her a cube of sugar. So I put that in. While I was putting the harness and stuff on him, I slipped another to him. And then when I went out, had to hitch to a cultivator and went to, I was supposed to go to a certain field, and it was right across the field from where five or six guys were working. They all stopped and looked, you know. Hey, how was I managing that? In a few weeks, the foreman had a brother that was 6, 7 years older than I was, and he was working a big gray and a big bay. So we were talking, and he says, you know, you've got the best team here. I said, I know I have it. They are the best team. The guy on the water wagon, the water wagon hit a deer, hit a rough, low spot, a little mud, and I was going by with the team, and I said, hey, I can pull that out for you. And his team was larger than mine, and I went down. There's always a trick to do things. So I hitched him up, and I backed the team up, and then I turned them to go side way instead of going straight ahead. And they stepped forward, got that, went down, and pulled that wagon out. So it was, I've had a good life. And my wife and I, we've had really a nice time.
So tell me, you mentioned briefly your experiences on Christmas Eve. Tell me that story.
Okay. We were going up the Seine River up to Rouen and unloading up there. We made several trips because the bulge had started on the 16th of December. We were getting closer. Coming back down, after we had to have a pilot going up and coming down. And we slowed down after we got out to let the pilot, and someone, for some reason, General Quarters had sounded. Well, when General Quarters sounded, I had to be there. And the captain, and we couldn't find out why the general quarters sound. And so feed all ahead standard. And then he said, hey, this is Christmas Eve. And he says, how about going full, which was above standard, you know. I said, well, captain, after I gave the orders, he down to the wheelhouse. I said, well, captain, why not go flank? And he said, well, okay. So we went flank, and he says, now, should we turn our running lights on? Some of the ships had been using running lights for about 4 or 5 weeks. And I said, no. He said, why not? I said, someone in the German high command might have read about George Washington crossing the Delaware and surprising the British. And I said, if they've got any subs left, they will be here tonight. He said, okay, we stay blacked out. There again, I caught the midnight watch, and as soon as I went on, why, we could still put on 40 RPMs on. So I called the engine room, had them to add it, you know. And then about an hour later or so, we caught up with an LST going the same way we were going at standard speed. And they sent out with the blinker lights, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. I wasn't too happy about it, but I had my signal to return the message, you know. And then another hour and a half or so, 2:30 or so, caught up with another one, and the same thing happened. And I came almost telling them a lie that, hey, there's subs here. You shouldn't be descending that. So we're, but I didn't. I had our guy return it. When I went off duty at 4 o'clock, I did leave a message for the navigator that I had put those on, or 40 RPGs on. And it was close to 8 o'clock when one of the radio men brought me a message that I had to decode. And see, and I had a room of myself, and on the, I had the safe welded to the deck, and I used the top of the safe from my bed desk. So I decoded the message. What it was, those two LSTs had been torpedoed. There were some several other other ships had been torpedoed. And then there was a Belgian troop ship that had picked up American troops at Southampton to take to Cherbourg, France. In fact, there were two of them. But one of them made it, and one didn't. Within 5 miles of Cherbourg, it was torpedoed. And the Belgian sailors took off for shore. And the American soldiers didn't know how to use the radio on that Belgian ship. But when the Belgian sailors got to shore, they did report it, and a couple of vessels came out to get them. But a number of our American soldiers was killed. The weather was rough. It seemed like all the time. Jumping from the Belgian ship to the rescue ship, they were smashed. That's a terrible death. A number of them were. And then a few days later, sometime later, we found out exactly the number that was killed that night, Americans, soldiers. That was 762. It's hard to take. And it wasn't, it shouldn't, well, there's another deal that bothered me. All of it was in, still in June. Actually, it was probably around the 24th, 25th of June. We were sitting high and dry and was getting ready to go back to England, and I was going to be going on watch. And, you know, thousands of ships there's out there, as you see, but there was one area. And when the captain came up for us to leave, to back off, why, he said, gosh, he said, that's a good spot to anchor. And I said, well, Captain, I've been looking at that, and I've got a very odd feeling about it. I said, why isn't anybody there? Did they know something that we don't know? And I said, I would like to go all the way out and anchor out there. He said, well, okay. And he left the bridge. And then I looked over, way over the port. There was a British troop ship had slowed down at the edge of some ships. I thought they was going to anchor. And then they saw that spot, and they made a 45-degree turn and speeded up. They were really for speed. Well, it looked to me like we might get there about the same time that we'd cross it. So I had all the engines stopped, and we managed to, by just the rudder, to maneuver. And finally, I had to start, when I started the starboard engine, and just ahead one-third. And that ship ran in there, and he was stopped his engine to reverse. He was still going forward. He dropped the anchor while they were still going forward. Well, that was dropped in a nest of mines. And you can't believe that whole front was blown. And troops going up there with legs, arm, and shoulder and stuff. And it was a, and I think there might have been an explosion also on the bow of that ship. When the captain heard the noise, he came up and he looked at what was happening and stuff. He turned to me and said, Mr. Heron, anytime you have one of those odd feelings, you just anchor any place you want to. And I figured that there was probably from at least 400, maybe up to 600, the British troops was lost that morning, because they probably had from 2,000 to 3,000 on that ship. And we went on by and we anchored. So then after I went off duty, I went up on the bow of the ship and I sat there and I thought of that. When we anchored, we were always moving backwards when we dropped. And there was only three or four up there where we dropped the anchor, got order dropped the anchor. Now, we could have dropped the anchor and maybe only lost three or four. Our week might have not hit a nest of mines. We might have not lost anybody. So I sat up there for 3 or 4 hours, and that was one of the, a very, could have prevented it by beating that ship in and dropping our anchor. This was the week after the big storm, and there were bodies floating in, and there were small boats out picking up bodies. And here came down, I was sitting on the bow, here came this British officer floating, and he was just like he was in a recliner chair, and the eyebrows was coming off his fingers, you know. But he hit the front of our ship floating, and but about 100 feet down, a small boat picked him up. There's a lot of things that happened.
Do you think that the war changed you as a person?
It made me a better person, much better.
In what way?
Well, I had more patience for other individuals, which I might have not had before. And I looked at things entirely different. What are we on this earth for? To help people. That's what we're here for. And this is what we should do. My wife and I, we do things. Like we furnish for the third grade student here in Vermilion, they get a special dictionary. It's a product of the auxiliary, Legion Auxiliary program, but we don't have many members. We don't have much money. We have been, as soon as school starts, we ask the public school, the principal, how many students you have, call St. Agnes Catholic School, ask them, and then we order these third grade dictionaries, and they're made especially for third graders. See, my wife taught third grade for 30 years. See, so it isn't a big dictionary for everybody, for third grader. But in there, it has something about every state, when the state, all 50 states, when they became a state, area of the state, and the population of the state. Then it goes to all of every foreign country. It has every foreign country the same way. And it's got the territory, the size, and the population, and the type of government in those, you know. So it's got all of those. It has the Braille system in there. It also has the long word of the English word, and there are the number of letters, and you'd never guess it if you tried. It's 1,909 letters in one word.
Really?
Yes. It's a medical term, and then it talks to him about that. But the money that we spend for those dictionaries, this is our fourth year. We ordered and we sent a check to South Carolina on the first day of September. We know how many kids. There'll be about 95 or so in the public school and 9 in the Catholic school. And as soon as they come, we will present them. We have. This will be our fourth year. We get a big kick out of the letters that these students write back to us. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing what they say. And one little boy in one letter, he says, I hope you got enough money to do it next year. Twin girls in the third grade. And one of them said, we've got a sister that's in the first grade. I hope you'll be doing it when she reaches the third grade.
So do you think that, I've talked to some veterans who think that they're shocked when they talk to young people today that don't, by how much they don't know about World War II. Do you find that in your experience?
Well, yeah, I had very many people knew about and know anything about the flying bomb. Well, I'm not sure exactly when it started. I sort of fouled up a little that night. I was going to, there again, I was going to watch it at night. So I always, and we were always the last ship in the column, and there was several columns, you know. I always stopped in the chart room and looked to see where we was at if we're going to make a turn or anything. And as soon as I walked in the chart room, a couple of the guys started talking to me about the planes that was flying over. And I said, oh, and said they could see the exhaust. And I said, no, you can't do it. Oh, yes, it's a ball of fire. And so I went on. I didn't look. I went on and went up. The OD on duty, he was telling me about all those planes going over. And I said, I don't see any. And pretty soon they came. And there it was, this ball of fire coming out. I said, those aren't planes. I mean, they're not pilots. I looked at them on binoculars, and there weren't. And that was the first time they came over. That was a lot of them. But the Germans made a mistake when they made those. They had them set so they could go a certain distance and go down at a certain spot. The mistake they made, when they would start to go down, and when they got, instead of being on the level, when they got down just 15 degrees, engine stopped. And down they came. So none of them ever hit the spot that they were supposed to. Lyman Henry, our navigator, and I, we always try to get a little exercise when we got to port in England. So one night we were walking, and it was at Tilbury, and we were walking just as fast as we could. And we wanted to walk 4 or 5 miles and get some exercise. And here we saw one plane coming over, and we saw it coming, and then it started. About face, both of them said at the same time. And we turned and walked as fast as we could in the opposite direction, and it went hit down about 2 blocks from where we were at. And of course, they had another one that you never saw it, never heard it until it hit. There's some of it hit in London and different places. See, it didn't last very long because the Americans, we captured the factory where those things were made. And see, and I've got the picture of them and going to practice the blueprint.
Very good. What else did you bring pictures of?
I brought this back. It tells the ribbons and things that I'm entitled to wear, plus a bronze star, which I never did bother to get. I don't like to show that stuff. Also, my picture, and here's a picture of my ship. Here's a name tag I used in the deal. And these are three ships that they were there on when the Germans surrendered. That we got word of that. Those are there. And here's 5 pages of things that did during the time I was there. Here's a picture of 528.
So you've written a lot about your war experiences. You've
Oh, sure,
written
I
a
did it
lot of
for my
stories.
grandkids.
What do you think that they get out of this? Do you, I mean, what do you hope to pass on to them with all
Well,
of these stories?
that if necessary, they need to serve their country. And our oldest grandson is, he's 27 years old, turning in June. He's a captain in the Air Force. He flies the C-17s, that's the big cargo planes. A year ago, he was flying the Learjet, the C-21s, and he was over there for 3 months at that time, and he was in 12 different countries while he was there. And the past some weeks ago, he sent us a picture of the passenger that was the president of Afghanistan. I can't pronounce it. I
Afghanistan.
didn't have the right training in grade school. But a picture of the president, and that he'd spent a day in our Patrick spent a day in Germany because he took this president there that met with President Bush in Germany. And there's this large picture of him and this president of that. And of course, he went to Colorado Springs and got a degree in engineering mechanics. See, they don't teach them to fly there, but they have to carry 19 semester hours because their time is on that.
So do you think that you're writing and you're telling him all of these stories, does that kind of, did that kind of inspire him to
Yes, and I
service
think
country?
in fly, oh, he earned his, he got his pilot's license right out of high school. So he was in his 5th year, the 1st year that after he graduated from Colorado Springs, he was scheduling flights from Wright-Patterson. And then the next year, they took him to Oklahoma and taught him to fly. And that was the C-21s, the Learjets. It's just 6 seats in there. They do have a jump seat so they can go to the toilet.
Is there one thing that you would like people to know about your World War II experiences?
I think that we should, and maybe I've said it before, that we are on this earth to help people. Otherwise, why are we here? And I think having served and seeing the casualties that I saw and different things during the war, that it has made me a much better person. I'm more aware of my faults and try to not say too much about the other person's faults. I'm very happy that I was able to serve. Now, I had an opportunity not to serve. I was majoring in economics, and in the spring of the end of my junior year, three of my econ professors were called to Washington, D.C. One was sent down to Cuba a month earlier, and Dr. Parrish, he wanted me to go with him. He says, all you'd have to do is to take a civil service exam and you'd have no problem doing that. And I said, we can certainly use you. And I said, no. I said, I'm in no hurry to go to service, but I would feel out of place if I didn't. And see, I registered for the draft, 20-year-olds had to register for the draft on February the 16th of 1942. And I didn't hear from the draft board until August, 6 months later. And then I went and talked to them, and they said, your number's coming up the first week of October. So I already knew what I was going to do because this V7 program that they had, that if you had 3 years of college, well, you could enlist, it put you on an active duty, and so on and so forth. So I never thought, growing up in the 30s, Knute Rockne, the coach of Notre Dame, that I'd ever see Notre Dame play, but I did. I felt I've been very, very fortunate, living in this town of Vermilion. And we didn't have to come here, but we visited with the public school system and with the university before we came. Our kids were 3 and 5 at that time. So they went through kindergarten, through high school, through the university here. My wife only had 3 years of college when we came here. She got her bachelor's and master's here. In fact, she was the first woman public school teacher that earned a master's degree. Then the others started doing it. Also, our daughter got her bachelor's and master's here, and she's been president of a corporation in Louisville, Kentucky. Our son, he went to high school, and the university here majored in math and history both. And I always kidded him that his teachers, instructors knew that he only knew the first letter of the alphabet, so that's what they gave him. And then he got a scholarship to Duke University, and he made money going to school because he had a National Science Foundation grant also. Okay. So we've been very fortunate. We've got 2 good kids. We've got 3 good grandkids. We've got a good life, but we're getting older. I turned 86 this past Friday.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your stories with us.
I'm very happy to do it.